Hi, I'm Cameron Wilson from Bush Telegraph. Your chosen program is coming shortly, but you might also like to try the Bush Telegraph podcast for stories from rural and regional Australia. We look at topical stories and tales of life in the bush. You'll find us on the RN website.
And we're just hearing now from North Korean state media that this was a nuclear test. They're saying it was conducted as part of measures to protect our national security and sovereignty against the reckless hostility of the United States.
Whether it's posturing or propaganda, Pyongyang likes to do it with all guns blazing. This latest broadcast from North Korean state TV shows soldiers blasting away at targets painted with "Kill the USA."
North Korea has again upped the ante, announcing it will restart all of its mothballed nuclear reactors. The United States has moved to counter the threats, putting a warship off the country's coastline.
For the past 3 months, tensions on the Korean Peninsula have increased yet again. In February, North Korea carried out its third nuclear test. The UN responded by imposing yet more sanctions. North Korea then threatened the US with a preemptive nuclear strike. And from there, it just got worse. So what's going on in North Korea? And why has the relationship between North Korea and the United States been in a state of tension for over half a century? Hello, this is Rear Vision on RN and via the web. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this week, the story behind the current political and nuclear crisis on the Korean Peninsula. Like much of the world, the Korean Peninsula was shaped and reshaped by the Cold War. But before we even get to that, it's important to understand that prior to the division of the Korean Peninsula in 1945, Korea had been unified for centuries. As Bruce Cummins, Professor of History at the University of Chicago and the author of The Origins of the Korean War, explains.
Well, the Korean Peninsula was one unified entity going back more than a millennium. It had a very well-recognized integrity south of the Yalu River since the medieval era. And therefore, the division of the peninsula since 1945 has been a particularly difficult thing for Koreans to take, and essentially unprecedented in their history going back to the 10th century AD.
The Korean Peninsula was one of the first regions occupied by Imperial Japan in 1910. It remained under Japanese control until the end of World War II. The decision to divide the peninsula occurred in 1945, moments before liberation. And according to Bruce Cummins, it was a decision made behind closed doors in Washington, D.C.
Well, two of the most important people in post-war American foreign policy were sitting in the War Department a day after Nagasaki had been obliterated on August 10th, late in the evening. And John J. McCloy, who was a lawyer for the oil industry and later High Commissioner of Germany and once nominated to be the chairman of the American foreign policy establishment, he asked Dean Rusk, John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson's Secretary of State, to go into an adjoining room and find a place to divide Korea, given that Soviet forces had already entered the war and were fighting the Japanese in northern Korea. And Rusk later wrote that he looked on a map, I think it was a National Geographic map, and noted that the 38th parallel nearly bisected the peninsula. But most important, Rusk said that Seoul would be in the southern zone, the American zone. And so they drew that fateful line without consulting anybody. No Koreans, of course, but they didn't even consult our British allies or the Russians, who were our allies at the time. But the primary purpose of that division was to staunch the inflow of Soviet forces and the Korean guerrillas that the American State Department thought were with them. State Department vastly overestimated the numbers at about 35,000. And Rusk later wrote that he was rather pleased with the Soviet decision to accept the 38th parallel and not to move below it, even though the U.S. couldn't get troops into Korea for 3 weeks.
And I'm just wondering, what was the impact in Korea, and was it as traumatic as the division of Germany was in Europe?
Well, I think it was more traumatic, much more so, in that, first of all, there was no justice in it. I once had an undergraduate student ask me why Japan wasn't divided at the end of 1945 instead of Korea. I never quite thought of it before, but of course Japan was the aggressor as Germany was, and had it been divided, it would have been seen as their just desert. Korea, which had been one of the first victims of Japanese aggression, was divided. And the Cold War really began there almost instantly. The U.S. set up a full military occupation and started off after anybody who was to the left of Harry Truman.
Korean prisons are now fuller of political prisoners than under the Japanese rule. The torture and murder of the political enemies of the extreme right is apparently an accepted and commonplace thing. The American G2 is too concerned with the suppression of the left to inquire too closely into the methods adopted by their Korean agents. From the head of the Australian mission in Tokyo, Mr. Patrick Shaw, November 11th, 1947.
While America began reshaping South Korea to fit its own political ends, the Soviets threw their weight behind Kim Il-sung. Dr. Tat Yang Kong, lecturer in politics from the School of Oriental and African Studies at London University, explains.
Kim Il-sung had established himself as quite an effective guerrilla leader in Manchuria during the 1930s. Initially, there was no Korean Communist Party, and Kim Il-sung was actually a member of the Chinese Communist Party, although this was later obscured in North Korean official accounts. So initially, Kim Il-sung established himself as a medium rank guerrilla commander working under Chinese commanders. And what happened was that the Japanese suppression campaigns were so effective, it forced Kim Il-sung and his bands to retreat into Soviet Far East in 1940. And how Kim Il-sung managed to build up his position was that he won the backing from the Soviet Union during his time there. In 1945, all the well-known, the most famous of the Korean communists, the most senior ones, they all went to Seoul, expecting Seoul would be the center of a unified Korea. Whereas Kim Il-sung arrived in Pyongyang in 1945, and all his senior potential rivals going to Seoul and taking part in the politics of the South, allowing Kim Il-sung to, with the backing of the Russians, to consolidate what was very much a separate regime in the North between 1945 and 1948.
Despite the division of the peninsula, both the regimes in the North and the South believed that Korea should and would be unified. They, however, disagreed on which one of them was the legitimate government. And it was this disagreement that eventually led to conflict.
Eventually, you had a political struggle in the first year or two after World War II ended, then a guerrilla struggle that got going in 1947 and lasted almost up to the Korean War. A lot of border fighting, which was quite severe in the summer of 1949. And then the North Koreans invaded in June 1950, and they themselves thought a number of things. One, the 38th parallel was enforced by foreigners. It had no standing whatsoever in international law. And second, the South Koreans had wanted to fight in the summer of 49. They started the majority of the fighting, according to our commander, American commander on the scene. But North Korea had tens of thousands of soldiers fighting in China with the Chinese communists. They didn't get those soldiers back until January 1950. They started coming back. One entire division of the People's Liberation Army in China was made up of Koreans, and it essentially changed, I think it was the 155th Division, to the 5th Division of the North Korean Army, and it was posted right above the 38th parallel in the spring of 1950. And those blooded and experienced troops became the shock forces of what was a quite successful invasion that would have cleared away the South Korean Army and South Korean government quite quickly had the U.S. not come into the fighting. So it was fundamentally a civil war, but by 1950, the Cold War was so deep and so tense, with the Soviets having blown off their atomic bomb and the Chinese communists having unified their country, that North Korea was just seen as a pawn and a puppet of Soviet Union. It was, in fact, a very local war, but it was, it was interpreted in that way.
At 4 a.m. on Sunday, June 25th, 1950, the communists launched an attack in force across the 38th parallel in a treacherous attempt to destroy the Republic of Korea.
The Korean War began in 1950 and continued until an armistice was signed in 1952. As Marcus Noland, senior fellow at the Institute for International Economics in Washington, and the author of Avoiding the Apocalypse, The Future of the Two Koreas explains. It was a war that devastated both North and South Korea.
The character of the war, which involved the North Korean army almost winning, going all the way down to the extreme southern end of the peninsula, and then being repulsed by South Koreans supported by a UN contingent, which was dominated by the United States, but also included troops from a number of countries, including Australia, pushing all the way back up the peninsula, at which point the Chinese entered the war to prevent a North Korean defeat. And then the army moved back south again. And in the end, you had had two sets of armies completely traverse the peninsula twice, completely devastating it, and the original borders were more or less reestablished. That was truly traumatic. It involved enormous amount of physical destruction, huge population movements, enormous amounts of population dislocation and divided families. And in that sense, from 1952 on, when the armistice was signed, until the present, the experience of Korea has been far more traumatic than what happened in Germany.
Tonight we greet with prayers of thanksgiving the official news that an armistice was signed almost an hour ago in Korea. And so at long last, the carnage of war is to cease and the negotiations of the conference table is to begin.
It was a very, very devastating war, and yet it's never ended. Only an armistice holds the peace. There never was a peace treaty ending the war, and so we're technically still at war with North Korea.
But even when the fighting was over, the American troops stayed in the South.
Yes, we had 60,000 troops after the war, and Richard Nixon took out one division, which dropped it to 40,000, which is essentially where it stayed ever since until Don Rumsfeld took a combat brigade of about 9,000 soldiers out to fight in Iraq. So that's why there are only about 30,000 now.
Under the auspices of the United Nations, the U.S. has maintained a troop presence in South Korea since the end of hostilities in 1952. And those troops are being reduced, but they still number something on the order of 30,000 troops. In the North, there have been no, at least not large numbers of foreign troops, but the North itself has developed the most militarized society on Earth. If you measure the share of men or share of people under arms in the working age population or other similar indicators of the degree of militarization, North Korea is the most militarized society on Earth.
In the late 1940s, the North Korean regime was a real coalition of the left that included communists of different stripes and also nationalists and literary figures. South Koreans long denied this, but now understand it, you know, that many of the leading cultural figures in the South went to the North during the 1940s. I think the war had a kind of cauterizing effect on the North Korean leadership that caused Kim Il-sung to get rid of a lot of these people. There was an attempted coup against him in 1956, and he responded with draconian measures. And within a decade or so, into the 60s, he had established this so-called Juche philosophy that is much more a matter of Korean nationalism than it is Marxism-Leninism. And then that has been drummed into the people's heads ever since. You know, they call it self-reliance and all of that, but it's fundamentally a virulent kind of Korean nationalism. And I would say that up until around 1965 or 6, there still was room for dissidents on the left or for presenting, you know, alternative histories to the one that Kim Il-sung and his scribes always write. But that since the mid-60s, there has been a totalitarian state that actually would probably go beyond what Stalin created. And part of that is that Kim Il-sung is often seen by his own people and his son as a kind of king rather than a communist leader. South Korea had hundreds of years of monarchy and hundreds of years of people singing the praises of how great their kings were. And the North Koreans have translated this into a kind of modern nationalist and communist politics that is quite bizarre and unbelievable, really, when you're there. I thought before I went there that a lot of their stuff was for foreign consumption. It turns out, you know, what you see in their foreign propaganda is what you get at home.
You're listening to Rear Vision on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, and via your MP3 player with me, Annabel Quince. In today's program, we're taking a look at the history behind the current nuclear crisis with North Korea. As Dr. Tan Yang Kong explains, the first nuclear threat on the peninsula came not from North Korea, but rather from America.
During the Korean War, the United States threatened to use nuclear weapons against China. And this was the first indication to Kim Il-sung of the potential of having nuclear weapons. But from 1957 onwards, the United States deployed nuclear weapons in South Korea, mainly in the form of nuclear artillery shells, nuclear mines. And the deployment of nuclear weapons in South Korea allowed the United States and the South Koreans to compensate for what they felt was numerical disadvantage against the larger North Korean forces. So the presence of American deployment of nuclear forces in the South, on the one hand, was seen by Kim Il-sung to be a threat, and also it gave him an indication of how having nuclear weaponry could compensate for weaknesses in conventional forces. So the interest dates all the way back to the 1950s and 1960s. However, the desire to acquire the nuclear weapons wasn't really that strong during the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, because the North Koreans felt that their alliance with the Soviet Union and China, both nuclear powers, compensated for their lack of nuclear weapons, that they themselves had a type of nuclear umbrella being provided by the Soviet Union. The South Koreans in the 1970s, in the aftermath of the American failure in Vietnam, also were interested in acquiring nuclear weapons.
The actual North Korean nuclear program started in the 1950s, mainly with Soviet help and a little help from the Chinese. Now, one has to be clear, in the 1950s, countries all over the world were developing small nuclear programs for scientific reasons, for research reasons, or frankly for pure prestige reasons. So the fact that the North Koreans developed a small nuclear industry in the 1950s is not necessarily indicative that they were planning to pursue nuclear weapons going back that far, though it is almost certain that Kim Il-sung had a great interest in nuclear weaponry. What we know for sure is sometime in the 1980s, a program which may have been started for all sorts of reasons clearly developed a military goal, and the North Koreans have pursued that goal of developing nuclear weapons resolutely now for about two decades.
Bruce Cummins disagrees and argues that for many years the North Korean nuclear industry was directed at the production of electricity.
Well, the Soviets, in return for selling them the plutonium reactor at Yongbyon, required them in 1985 to join the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And it seemed that for several years, North Korea's nuclear program was primarily one to supply electricity, much like South Korea and Japan, who have no petroleum, rely so much on nuclear-generated energy. But when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, and the North Koreans said this quite publicly, they said they were under threat from American nuclear weapons, which was true. We had nukes installed in South Korea from 1958 until 1991. And given that there was no longer a Soviet Union, they may have to develop weapons that they had heretofore relied on their friends for. And they began bargaining with their plutonium reactor as the bargaining chip to try and find a new relationship with the U.S., and particularly to get the U.S. out of the category of an enemy state. And this lasted for 3 years. It came to a crisis in June 1994 when President Clinton was just about to mount a preemptive strike on the huge plutonium complex. And then Jimmy Carter intervened. He talked directly to Kim Il-sung and got a freeze on that reactor. And that, at the time, and I think ever since, showed that North Korea was willing to give up its nuclear program for normalization of relations with the U.S. and some kind of guarantee that we wouldn't attack them.
While Mr. Carter is declaring that the nuclear crisis is over, he's warning the U.S. not to impose economic sanctions against the North.
North Korea was not likely to resort to threats or international pressure or embarrassment or condemnation. That the alternative had to be something that would let them and us save face, to let us come out of this in a peaceful way, and the only way I could see was to establish some form of communication.
In the spring of 1994, the United States and North Korea almost went to war. That was averted by a visit of former President Jimmy Carter to Pyongyang, where he basically cut a deal with Kim Il-sung that in return for the North Koreans freezing certain nuclear weapons-related activities, the United States and a coalition or consortium of countries would provide the North Koreans with two nuclear reactors that would be less prone to proliferation than the ones that they had in operation. That deal has subsequently come apart.
The official Korean Broadcasting Service announcing the death of 82-year-old President Kim Il-sung.
Kim Jong-il replaced his father as leader, just as the North Korean economy was going into freefall.
The North Korean economic crisis, the collapse of the North Korean economy by something like 50% between 1994 and 1999, sent out the signal to the Americans that North Korea was not a viable entity. So the Americans were always rather slack in carrying out the program to deliver the two light water reactors. The feeling was in the United States, if the North Korean economy is going to collapse anyway, is it really worthwhile following through on this deal? And on the North Korean side, they perceived was this was a lack of faith on the American side. And their view was the only way to keep the Americans on track was to actually develop further nuclear and missile programs in order to show the Americans that they were still in business, that if they were either neglected or coerced, they still had the capacity to make trouble. And for the Americans, the North Korean development of, say, a missile, ballistic missile in 1998, the evidence of new nuclear programs, for the Americans, this showed that the North Koreans were cheating. But also, I would say, the effect of the new Republican administration, which came to power in 2001. President George W. Bush was always skeptical about dealing with a regime like North Korea. He was always skeptical about engagement. And the effect of 9/11 confirmed that view for President Bush. After 9/11, the American view of the world became very, very polarized. There were either terrorist supporting states or the coalition of Democrats led by the United States. And so North Korea was squarely placed in the evil camp.
In defense of the Bush administration, I have to say, though, that it became increasingly apparent in the late 1990s, starting in 1998 and going into the early years of the Bush administration, that the North Koreans were cheating on the agreement by developing a second nuclear program, a second secret nuclear program via the AQCON network.
I think it's important to understand that the Bush administration was very split about what to do regarding North Korea from the very beginning. Colin Powell wanted to take up where the Clinton people had left off in an engagement policy and said that openly, whereas Bush has said, well, he doesn't trust Kim Jong-il, which of course raised the question, who does? Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney had bombing plans for North Korea, somewhat like the one Seymour Hersh revealed regarding Iran. But of course, the Iraq war has gone so badly that the U.S. is terribly bogged down there and doesn't really have troops to spare.
During the first term of the Bush administration, certainly with the axis of evil speech, the relations between North Korea and United States, which had tentatively built up under the Clinton administration, certainly deteriorated. However, there was a pickup in the second term of the Bush administration in 2007, 2008, under the auspices of the six-party talks. They actually reached a tentative agreement. They actually arrived at some principles for further negotiation. However, in 2008, it was the American presidential cycle. I think the North Koreans were biding their time, seeing what would happen with the change of U.S. administration. They were hoping perhaps they would get a better deal under the Obama administration. So what seemed to be the beginnings of a working relationship towards the end of the Bush administration actually came to nothing.
Recall that earlier generations faced down fascism and communism not just with missiles and tanks. They understood that our power alone cannot protect us, nor does it entitle us to do as we please. Guided by
In his inaugural address, President Obama extended his hand to North Korea and Iran, North Korea responded within weeks of the Obama inauguration with a nuclear test followed by a missile test. So President Obama comes into office. He's facing the worst economic catastrophe since the Great Depression. He has two wars going on in Iraq and in Afghanistan. He's ready to talk to the North Koreans, and they respond by nuclear test and missile test. So the Obama administration made the completely understandable political calculation that there was nothing to be gained here. Basically, we went into 4 years of what is called strategic patience.
I think it was recognized by the North Koreans, and they were hopeful that they would get a better deal under the Obama administration. Perhaps the Obama administration would pick up from where the Clinton administration left off in 2000. But then when the North Koreans realized that the United States was certainly not going to make any further concessions, I think then they reverted back to the old strategy, essentially demonstrating power, demonstrating their resolve that they cannot be ignored.
In 2011, the North Korean Supreme Leader Kim Jong-il died.
Kim Jong-il's Swiss-educated 29-year-old son Kim Jong-un is set to take over the dynasty that's controlled the North for more than five decades.
Well, with the change in leadership, there was great hope that there might be change. Kim Jong-un's life is shrouded in a certain amount of mystery, but it's believed that he spent a certain amount of time in a boarding school in Switzerland and may have been, in a sort of general sense, more exposed to the West, more cosmopolitan than his father. And so the hope was, when he came to power, that he would be a little more forward-looking. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case. If anything, his behavior appears to be even more bellicose than his father's.
Behind Kim Jong-un, there's actually a committee. They have a decision-making committee called the National Defense Commission. Kim Jong-il did what he could to transfer as much power and as much knowledge to his son as possible. It's not Kim Jong-un alone. It was not Kim Jong-il alone. I think the difference between Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un would be that Kim Jong-il was more experienced. He had been effectively running the party for 20 years before he came to power, and he could more directly control the levers of power. He had more authority. Kim Jong-un very much needs to prove himself, and he needs to work within the context of collective decision-making.
So why is North Korea's leader driving the peninsula to the brink of war? Some experts believe it's an attempt to impress the military hardliners he relies on to survive. Others say it's to force the United States to the negotiating table.
Certainly with regard to tensions, you know, I've been here in Seoul since the day of the third nuclear test, and there's very little sense of tension actually in Korea, in South Korea, on the streets. One also has to look at the other side. If you're from the North Korean perspective, the American military exercises deploying the most advanced weapons, like the B-2 bomber, very, very close to their border. I think from their perspective, this is also extremely threatening. So you might say this is like a tit for tat. We've been through these cycles before. Essentially, the North Koreans are trying to demonstrate their power and their resolve. You know, what they're seeking is the readiness of the United States to come to the negotiating table with them and treat them as equals, to talk with them without preconditions.
Dr. Tat Yang Kong from the School of Oriental and African Studies at London University. Our other guests, Marcus Nolan, Senior Fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, and Bruce Cummins, Professor of History at the University of Chicago. And if you're interested in knowing a bit more about the recent dispute between China and Japan over the islands in the South China Sea, check out our special feature this week. That's at abc.net.au/rn/revision. Today's sound engineers are John Jacobs and Philip McKellar. I'm Annabelle Quince, and this is Rear Vision on RN.
Yusli was arrested one night on suspicion of motorcycle theft.
Now available as a 360 Documentaries podcast. Hear how life's cheap for an Indonesian petty criminal.
The family received a call from the police. Yusli had resisted arrest. They shot him dead.
On 360 Documentaries this week, meet Yusli's sister, who's fighting to bring the police who shot her brother to trial. That's Eat, Pray, Mourn. Download or listen at the RN website.